You're listening to The Sound Off. The Sound Off. With the Solomonster. Solomonster.
The Rock is back to scratch a major itch. So enjoy your fruity pebbles, you yabba dabba bitch.
One of the women said that she was afraid she might OD. One of the women who was here.
What's that got to do with me? Winning.
We are winning here on the Sound Off, episode 149 this week. It is Saturday, March 5th, 2011. I am the Solomonster here with you as always. Thank you so much for downloading the podcast. I'm sitting here trying to figure out if the highlight of the week was Charlie Sheen or Bret Hart calling Hulk Hogan a dickhead on Twitter. And to me, there could be no greater insult than calling somebody the head of a dick. It doesn't get much lower than that. So it was an interesting week, and not quite sure what to say about that. But there it is. Yeah, Bret Hart and Hulk Hogan getting into a war of words on Twitter this week. You know, Bret was doing a Q&A on his Twitter page, and that's kind of how this whole thing got started. Somebody asked him I asked him a question, actually. About Jerry Lawler, and he was gracious enough to respond. And then somebody asked him a question about Hulk Hogan, and it just kind of went from there. So that's the background on that. Got a lot to get to, and I don't have a whole hell of a lot of time. I got to pack, and I got to get the fuck out of here, basically. So let's get right into this. Raw this past Monday night, of course, the road to WrestleMania in full effect. Best time of year to be a wrestling fan, but unfortunately, not so great on Monday night. I thought this show fucking sucked. We'll get some of the positives out of the way first. This show was not without its good stuff. It just so happened that the bad stuff was so bad it outweighed the good stuff. I thought the Jerry Lawler Michael Cole segment was great. I like the rub that Jack Swagger gets out of being appointed Cole's trainer for the match at WrestleMania. Some people were like, "Oh, Jack Swagger." But you know what? Jack Swagger would be sitting on his ass doing nothing at WrestleMania. And so now all of a sudden he's going to be involved in quite possibly the second or third most anticipated match on the entire show. You know, even if he's not wrestling, that's not a bad spot for him to be in on the show when pretty much for the last couple of months he's been having match after match with Kofi Kingston and not really going anywhere on SmackDown. And I liked it that when he went face-to-face with Lawler, you know, just the difference in sheer size between the two of them. I mean, Swagger looked like a giant standing over Lawler, and they've been doing a pretty good job of trying to get over his ankle lock as a finishing maneuver, so you know, I have no problem with that at all. And then Michael Cole, of course, makes mention of the fact that there's going to be a special referee now that he has accepted Jerry Lawler's WrestleMania challenge, and Lawler has accepted that provision. We don't yet know who the referee is going to be, although we kind of do. I would say that if you don't want any spoilers, a lot of you probably know this already, but if you don't, skip ahead 5 minutes. Just a little word of warning there. My first thought when I watched this segment was Jim Ross. You know, Jim Ross's head, his name popped into my head. And the more I thought about it, Vicky Guerrero seemed like a logical choice. She's been fired from SmackDown. Michael Cole has been, you know, for the most part, singing her praises now for the last several weeks. And there is no bigger heat magnet in this company right now, even more so than Michael Cole, than Vicky Guerrero. And, I thought maybe it's her. And then I realized that Steve Austin is on the show next week. Stone Cold being promoted for a Raw appearance. I'm sure there'll be some promotion for Tough Enough involved. And apparently Stone Cold is going to be the referee for the match at WrestleMania, at least according to most people. I'm curious, personally, to see how they explain this. Or if it perhaps leads to Jim Ross doing some announcing on the show. Because, you know, one of the big questions I have about this match is not so much about the match. The match is going to have a lot of bells and whistles and gimmicks. You're going to have Swagger in Cole's corner as a trainer, and you're going to have Steve Austin or whoever as the guest referee. There's been some rumors this week. Hulk Hogan kind of spilled the beans that Jimmy Hart might make a cameo on the show as Jerry Lawler's manager. There's a lot of history, for those of you who don't know, between Jerry Lawler and Jimmy Hart. Great feud back in Memphis in the 70s, I believe it was. But My big thing, and Michael Cole's been down in FCW for a while now, taking bumps. So obviously there's going to be something that happens at WrestleMania. Hopefully a good old-fashioned butt-kicking. But my big question is, where do you position this match on the show, and what happens after the match? Because unless this match is going to be kind of a buffer between the semi-main and the main event. And it's up in the air right now. Right now, as far as I know, Undertaker Triple H is scheduled to be the last match on the show, which I think is a mistake. But whatever that last match is, if you want to use the Cole Lawler match as a buffer, I wouldn't. This is a match that, in my opinion, should probably be the third or fourth match on the show. What do you do afterwards? You can't just have Michael Cole unless he beats up Jerry Lawler and wins, which I think pigs will fly before that happens. But, you know, let's say Cole gets beat up, Cole gets a stunner if Austin is the referee. You know, he's not going to go right back to the broadcast table. I mean, do you have Josh Matthews out there with, you know, Jerry Lawler? Maybe if he goes back to the announce booth and Booker T? I mean, I guess you can do that. Or do you bring back Jim Ross? Do you somehow work him in there, even if it's just for WrestleMania? Have him make a nice little cameo appearance and call the rest of the card. I mean, I certainly would not mind that. I just wonder what their frame of mind is. You know, the more I watch Michael Cole on TV, he reminds me of Vince McMahon. I'm sure Vince is kind of living vicariously through Cole. You know, he's been feeding him all of his lines. This is just classic Vince McMahon stuff from the Attitude Era. And Cole has been awesome. I mean, I will say that much. Michael Cole, in this particular role, is phenomenal. It's just that as an announcer, he's unbearable. So he has found his calling. I just don't know if it's going to lead to any sort of permanent position for him beyond WrestleMania. But there you have it. So it sounds like Austin's going to be the referee for this match. It will not be Vicky Guerrero because Cole went on SmackDown Friday night. And in referencing the referee, he kept saying him, him, him. So apparently it's not going to be a female. So that pretty much eliminates Vicky from the running. But I love this segment on Raw. Top-notch stuff. I really am into it. Lawler's great. Cole's been great. Swagger, I have no problem being involved. And we'll see how they work Austin. You know, I guess one way this might play out, and again, on Raw, on SmackDown on Friday, Cole referred to the referee as being somebody who is flamboyant and awesome. And, you know, that makes me think that perhaps he's going to pick The Miz to be the referee for the match. But the GM maybe dings in and doesn't allow it since he already has a title match on the show, and therefore he appoints Steve Austin the referee, and it kind of backfires on Cole. So something like that, I guess, would make sense, because otherwise, you know, why in God's name would Michael Cole make Jerry, or rather make Steve Austin the referee? You know, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. Rock's promo, probably the best thing on the show. Again, he was not live in the arena, and, you know, God bless the fans in Buffalo, you know, but my God, why tease them like that by playing his music at the beginning? Now, apparently, before they went to the segment during the commercial break, they did alert the crowd that they would be going to a Rock promo, basically letting them know that he would not be there live, which okay, if they did that, then that's great. Even though I'm sure that took the wind right out of their sails, but at least they let them know. Because I'm just sitting there thinking, man, they're playing his music. These poor people probably think he's coming out, and then he doesn't. I would be infinitely disappointed if I were them. But I thought the promo was great. And The Rock may be one of the few people in the entire wrestling industry who can do a taped promo and leave room for the fans to interact and for the fans to respond. And they actually do. You know, there were parts of the promo where they panned out to the crowd and they were basically sitting on their hands. Not because they were bored. I'm sure they were very disappointed The Rock was not there live, but they were paying attention to his promo. But when he asked them, you know, to chant along the millions, he did it three times. They responded every single time. It would have been really embarrassing if they didn't respond. But they did. They were playing along to a taped promo, and I think The Rock is probably one of the few people who can make that work. I really, really enjoyed this promo. Since Raw Monday Night, I've gone back and watched it about five or six more times. And there was an element to this that was actually missing. Don't get me wrong. I enjoyed his live in-ring promo that first week a little bit more. But this one was more personal. This one, you can see some real hatred and real emotion coming from him in that he was very much upset by those comments that Cena made. And the two of them have pretty much worked things out since then. But he's playing off real emotions that he had back in 2008 when Cena first said those things in that UK Sun interview. And it really made for a very believable, very intense promo. Clearly The Rock was pissed off by John Cena jacking his jaw. And now he's, like he said, he's going to pay the price. There's consequences to be paid for your actions. I thought him starting the promo with the, you know, the sidewards baseball cap, you know, pretending to be the rapper Cena was fantastic. It was great. And then when he pulled all the shit off and, you know, he's saying, you know, of course you address me in the form of rap, you know, because you're the guy with the purple shirt, you know, and he's spouting off all of Cena's funny little catchphrases. And, I just thought this was a fantastic promo. And, Rock teased that he will be on Raw before WrestleMania. He didn't say when. He said that Cena would see him sooner than he thinks. And from what I understand, that probably means the March 14th Raw, or perhaps the go-home edition of Raw right before WrestleMania. So it will likely not be this week. And why should it be? I mean, again, Rock should be used sparingly on TV, but you have Steve Austin on the show this Monday night. You don't have to have Austin and Rock on the same show. And I would love to see some interaction with Austin and The Rock. Save it for WrestleMania. Save it for a little cute backstage skit at WrestleMania. You don't need both of them on the same show. You know, they've got a lot of things to promote. Austin is a big attraction. They've got the next, you know, Cole's going to announce the guest referee, which, again, is probably going to be Austin. They don't need Rock on the show this week. Cena apparently is promising a, quote, knockout blow to The Rock. So a response to The Rock's response. And, you know, I enjoyed Cena's rap just because it was kind of, you know, again, it's old school Cena. You know, he would cut these raps. They're very creative. He does them on his own. I think it works for his gimmick. I would not say that in round one, Cena scored what he said at the time was a knockout blow. I would give round one to The Rock, and I would certainly give round two to The Rock so far. So I'm curious to see how Cena responds on Monday night. The only problem I see with all of this, and I might have said this last week, this is the best promotion for a match that we are never going to see. And it's really, again, Rock is certainly able, if he wants, to change his mind and could step back in the ring for one more match, and he can choose John Cena to be his opponent. It's not going to be at WrestleMania, though. And all this does, as much as I love this stuff, and it makes Raw must-see TV, Raw's ratings have been up the last 2 weeks, a 3.9 2 weeks ago, a 3.8 this past week. No reason to think they should go down. I mean, Steve Austin is not the draw that he used to be, but still, you're promoting a show with Stone Cold. People, you know that John Cena is probably going to respond to The Rock, even if The Rock's not going to be there. If Raw does anything under a 3.7 this Monday night, I would consider that to be a huge disappointment. And then if they promote The Rock being on Raw this time and not you know, save it as a surprise. Let's say in 2 weeks he's going to be there live to confront John Cena. You promote that shit a week in advance, you're going to pop a 4.0 rating easily, as far as I'm concerned. So anyway, this is all great, but it just makes The Miz seem so unimportant. You know, The Miz is the WWE champion. They've done a very good job of making him seem unimportant anyway the first 2 months. Only in the last couple of weeks have they really gone out of their way to try to make The Miz look strong. And, you know, I just wonder if it's too little too late. People, I don't think, are ever going to look at Mike Mizanin as any sort of legitimate badass, because he's not. And when you have The Rock back on TV, and now Stone Cold, one of the greatest, most revered champions in the company's history, is coming back to TV, it makes people like The Miz just seem inferior. And The Miz, whether you like it or not, is your champion. He's defending the title in the main event against John Cena. I don't know what you do. You know, I don't know what you do with him at this point, but people are fired up about John Cena and The Rock. And somehow, and they may pay for WrestleMania anyway, knowing The Rock is going to be there, but it's I feel a little bit bad for The Miz, because he kind of gets caught in the crossfire here. And it's not even his fault. I am not blaming him at all. But, you know, even I am watching TV on Monday night thinking to myself, I don't even care about John Cena versus The Miz. I could care less about this match. And I'll get to why in a minute, because what they did with Cena and The Miz on Monday night, they almost completely destroyed this match. So I'm going to get to that in a second. But those are the only good things about Raw that I liked. I thought the HBK promo that they taped was pretty good. Again, they went from a taped Rock promo in Buffalo to a taped Shawn Michaels promo with neither man showing up in person. Sucks to be Buffalo, but, you know, the promo was fine. Basically, they were promoting it. I was kind of, intrigued by how they were promoting this. If you recall, before the commercial break, they were hyping it up. by saying that Shawn Michaels was going to, quote, sound off on the Triple H Undertaker match. Their words, not mine. Thought that was interesting. So, in any event, good promo. I was very surprised by the fact that Triple H, in his promo at the beginning of the show, did not mention Shawn Michaels by name one time. Or if he did, maybe I'm forgetting and he did, but my point is, I assumed that that first promo from Triple H was going to make mention of the fact that The Undertaker retired Shawn Michaels last year, and that somehow this was going to factor into why Triple H wanted The Undertaker in the ring, and at no point did that come up. In fact, the promo took a completely different turn, and it turned a lot of people off, and I was turned off too, but not because of the reason that you might be thinking. I thought the Triple H promo on Monday night was bad. Triple H can be a very boring, monotonous promo guy anyway. He can be a very, very good promo guy. This promo, you know, for a guy that I'm sure had free reign over what he was going to say, because again, him and The Undertaker, pretty much independent of the writers, are putting their entire program together. So this is not something that was scripted or suggested for him. He pretty much came up with this on his own. And he talked about, first of all, I thought it was interesting when he came out. Not to say that he didn't get a big reaction from the crowd, because he did. But it looked to me like he was expecting a Rock-level response from the crowd. And, he didn't get one. And I didn't think he would. He kept looking up at the WrestleMania sign, of course. A lot of people on Facebook pointed that out, because they know I hate that. And so, to that, I say that Triple H can go screw. He gets negative points for that alone. But, in all seriousness, the promo was not very good. And, like I said, surprised that there was no mention of Shawn Michaels. Surprised that the basic premise, apparently, for setting up this match at WrestleMania was he has done everything there is to do. He has looked around the locker room, and he sees absolutely no challenges left to be conquered. Now, everybody got their underwear in a bunch this week because, oh my God, he's burying the roster. He's burying everybody. They don't mean anything. Triple H is above everybody else. We already knew this. This is not brand new news to all of us. This is Triple H, after all, that we're talking about here. This didn't bother me at all. I was bothered by the fact that it was just a bad promo. It was a very weak, very boring promo from Triple H. There was no emotion. The reason he gave for challenging The Undertaker at WrestleMania was not good enough, in my opinion. You know, The Undertaker was off television for a couple of months. He came back, was making his grand return, and Triple H immediately comes out to, not verbally, but essentially challenge him to a match at WrestleMania. Triple H, remember, when he came out that first week, he looked really angry. He was really angry. He was really pissed off. And all I kept thinking was, well, he must be upset because The Undertaker retired his friend, and he wants to take revenge. Maybe next week or the week after, Triple H is going to talk about this, because I'm still expecting Shawn Michaels to be involved in this match in some way, to potentially be the guest referee. I still think the plan is to somehow include Shawn in this match. So they may get to it in a week or two. But for now, this was not the promo that I was expecting from Triple H. And again, the fact that he would say what he said, yeah, it didn't do the roster any favors. Apparently there were some wrestlers backstage, including one guy in particular who was loudly protesting and very pissed off that Triple H said what he said. You know, basically saying that everybody else backstage is like chopped liver. They don't mean anything at all. Even though Sheamus, for example, who came out and got his ass kicked, is the guy that put Triple H on the shelf for almost a year. Now, Triple H beat him. He beat him at WrestleMania last year. But Sheamus got the last laugh. He put Triple H in storyline. He put him out of action for about 10 months. And yet, here's Triple H coming out, not only not acknowledging Sheamus, but not even acknowledging that there's anybody backstage that really means a damn thing to him. He's won 13 world titles, which he has. He's won numerous other championships, King of the Ring, Royal Rumble, main event at WrestleMania more than once. First ballot Hall of Famer. What is there left for him to accomplish? And, again, to me, I didn't take it as a burial. I could see where people would. But I'm not really bothered by it, because the guy has won 13 world titles. He's 41 years old. I mean, it's not all that different from The Rock, who was not 41 when he retired. But The Rock, who in his own promo on Monday night when he talked about this, said that he did everything that he wanted to do. He left to pursue new challenges. Now, in Triple H's case, there is no new challenge for him to pursue other than running a company. He is WWE for life, or until he fucks someone not named Stephanie McMahon, and then he's unceremoniously gone from WWE, which I don't see happening. But the guy has done everything there is to do. At some point, what does it matter if you win a 14th world title? Or main event yet another WrestleMania? Again, my way of thinking was, I would like to think he was not burying anybody directly. Maybe he didn't mean to. He was just saying, I've done everything there is to do. I've had a match with almost everybody on this roster. Yeah, there's some new talent, but still. I'm 41 years old. Undertaker is the last of the Mohicans, so to speak, much like myself. He didn't say this, but he has had a WrestleMania match with Undertaker before. He lost. His best friend lost 2 years in a row. Undertaker drove his best friend batshit insane to the point where Shawn Michaels' career was ended because of it. So to me, if he were to actually come out and say that, which he didn't, that's enough of a reason for me to believe, you know what, I could see why this guy would want to get in the ring and end the streak. Undertaker took something special away from him. I want to take something special away from the dead man. That's all you have to do. And he didn't quite do that. And so that's the reason I didn't like this promo. Not because, you know, he buried people 6 feet under. But yeah, that was my thought on that. The rest of the show, the production crew was way off their game. There were lots of weird camera shots. And there was one point in the show where it was very Mike Tenay-esque. Because they did this at least one time in TNA where I vividly recall there was some sort of backstage or parking lot brawl going on that I think involved Abyss. And this was when Mike Tenay and Don West were doing commentary. And the camera, for whatever reason, even though there's nothing going on in the actual arena, pan back to Tenay and Don West, who were looking down and reading from a script. It was so blatant. It was so amateur. It was so second rate. You can find the YouTube video. It's high comedy. Not something I would expect WWE to do, but there they were, Monday night, the camera panning back to Michael Cole, who was doing a voiceover. He was describing what happened the week before, I believe in his own segment with Lawler. And for whatever reason, they pan back live to ringside in the middle of all this, and they show Cole basically looking down and reading off a script. So I thought that was pretty fucking stupid. Sheamus, what can you say? Poor guy is just treated like a jabroni. I mean, there's really nothing else to say. You know, Triple H beat the shit out of him, kicked him in the balls, threw him out of the ring, gave him a pedigree through the announce table, which I was a little concerned about because I, you know, anytime I see anything on the table, I think back to SummerSlam 2000 when the table broke when Triple H went to pedigree Kurt Angle and Kurt got knocked loopy. So thankfully that didn't happen then. Evan Bourne comes out, makes his big return, and pins Sheamus clean with a shooting star press in less than 30 seconds. So, and I don't think we saw Sheamus again for the rest of the show. I mentioned last week or the week before, the story is Kevin Dunn is not a big fan of Sheamus. Kevin Dunn, of course, is probably one of the top three people in that company. I would dare say even maybe the second most powerful person in WWE behind Vince McMahon. He's been with that company for, gosh, I mean, what feels like decades, certainly for over 20 years. And he's the, I believe his official title is the executive producer. You know, the Diva Search, for example, is one of his bright ideas that he's still dying to bring back. But, you know, and by the way, anybody who remembers, it was either the first season or the second season. I think it might have been the first season of Tough Enough when it aired on MTV. And there was one scene in particular where they were in, maybe it was Vince's office. And Kevin Dunn was on camera. He's got these big buck teeth. So I don't know. Anybody might remember that. They did show what he looks like on that show. So apparently that's the deal with Sheamus and why he's been just sliding right back down to the bottom of the mountain of late. He was perceived to have something of an ego. And I don't know if he actually did have an ego, if he was just projecting himself that way and just, you know, because, you know, when you're a star, that's what people tend to do. I don't know that Sheamus himself as a conceited individual. He seems to have a pretty good head on his shoulders. But in wrestling, politics can be a funny thing, and you rub one person the wrong way, and that's all it takes. You know, just ask guys like Carlito, and I mean, my God, I mean, I could probably think of about a dozen different names that have fallen victim to one stupid thing or another. So hopefully this is just something that blows over, and Sheamus can recover from it, because he's one of the few people that, in my opinion, in the last couple of years, really became a genuine main event star. Forget the two world titles that he kind of backdoored his way into. Sheamus was over as a main event guy, and they're trying to get The Miz over that way, and Alberto Del Rio, and perhaps John Morrison, and that's great. But they had somebody like that already. And what they've done in just the last couple of months, ever since really he won King of the Ring and had to wear that stupid robe and that stupid, stupid crown, they've undone everything. They have undone all of the progress they made with this guy. And if they're going to build him back up, they basically have to start from scratch. And I think that sucks. Just to think that there was, at one point, Sheamus was undefeated on television for months. And to go from that and being the world champion and feuding with Triple H and feuding with John Cena and being in the main event of a pay-per-view like Fatal 4-Way, winning the world title again, main eventing SummerSlam against Randy Orton, and just everything. And to see where he is now is, it's a travesty is what it is. It really is a travesty. I really don't think there's any better word for it than that. Daniel Bryan is another example. Now, Daniel Bryan has not yet gotten to the level that Sheamus was at. Daniel Bryan has not been a world champion in WWE. He has not main evented a pay-per-view unless you count SummerSlam when he was part of the big 7-on-7 against the Nexus. And he's been the U.S. champion for several months now, but unfortunately they've done nothing to make that title mean anything at all. I think Daniel Bryan has great matches. He's doing everything he could possibly do. It's like, trying to make chicken soup out of chicken shit, and he's done everything in his power to do it, but he can only do so much. And they have him come out for a match, I guess, and The Miz attacks him. Later on, The Miz says, well, I did it because I can, which is a fantastic excuse. The crowd was dead silent for this whole thing. They didn't know how to react to it, and it just makes the guy look like a bum. So, yet another star who, a guy who can become, again, a bona fide main event player. I really do believe, you know, Daniel Bryan is not the biggest guy. He's not the biggest dog in the hunt, so to speak. But the fans get behind him. The fans get into his matches. They get into his submissions. They buy into him. And WWE does everything in their power to just cut his legs off. And I just will never understand why they do the things they do. Now, Cena and The Miz. I don't want to spend too much time on this because I don't have a lot of time to talk, but I've got to get this off my chest. A couple of weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, whatever it was, we saw Cena come out and cut a freestyle rap on The Rock, and I thought it was great. You know, maybe you're not into the Cena gimmick at all and all the rapping stuff, so you're just going to hate John Cena no matter what. I thought that was fantastic. It was refreshing. It was different. It wasn't the same scripted, forced, fake bullshit. So I gave Cena a lot of props for that, and I thought it was great. And when he said that night that he was going to have to go old school one night only, boy, was he not joking. Because he came out this week and was the complete and polar opposite of what he was the week before. I really think he ought to rethink that position, because his promo this week made my skin crawl. I even wrote in my notes that I took during the show in all capital letters, it was not funny. There was not a single line, not a single point in his entire promo that I thought was funny. You know, sometimes he'll be doing that cutesy bullshit promo, and they'll have like a line in there that I even kind of chuckle at. Nothing. There was absolutely nothing to this promo that was entertaining in the least bit. Nothing redeeming about it whatsoever. He came out. He confronted The Miz. These are two guys that are supposed to be feuding for the championship in the main event of the biggest pay-per-view of the year, WrestleMania at the Georgia Dome, 60,000 people, and John Cena has his arm around The Miz like they're bosom buddies. And they're basically cracking jokes on Alex Riley, and, you know, Cena's telling him that Riley is the reason the people don't take The Miz seriously, which is a joke, of course. We all know why people don't take The Miz seriously. This is one shining example of it right here. The Miz would have won a lot of brownie points in my book if he would have been booked during this segment to while Cena had his arm around him, to just grab Cena's arm, break the fucking thing off and beat him over the head with it. The Miz would have been my favorite wrestler for all time if he would have done that. But of course, he stood there, he made funny faces, he just took it. He just took it, you know? To me, you're the world champion, you're supposed to be a tough guy. John Cena puts his hands on me, even if he's trying to put his arm around me, I slap him in the face, I kick him in the nuts, I beat the shit out of him and tell him, don't you put your hands on me. But that doesn't happen in WWE. So this was a complete abortion of a segment, quite frankly. And they build this up basically just to build a John Cena-Alex Riley cage match main event. Why a steel cage? No idea. They never explain why. And The Miz, who promised not to interfere, like a great heel, interfered anyway in a cage match. So what's the point of having the cage there? I don't know. So the match was what it was. The best part of the match didn't even involve Alex Riley or well, it kind of involved Cena. It was The Miz taking a picture through the cage fencing of Cena getting his ass kicked, taking a picture with his BlackBerry, which he did send that picture to his Twitter page, so I thought that was kind of cute. But here's what annoyed me about this match, and I mentioned this on Facebook. Can somebody explain to me, and they went out of their way to mention, that the only way to win that cage match was by escaping the cage. So, classic WWE cage match rules. No pinfalls, no submissions, obviously no countout or DQ. The only way to win is by escaping the cage. And so, I'm watching this match, and it took me a few minutes, and then I realized to myself, they have a referee on the outside. Which is fine. Somebody has to open the door, call for a winner. But they have referee Scott Armstrong inside the cage. Explain to me why you need a referee inside the cage in a match where the only way to win is by escaping the cage. And in a cage match, there are no rules to enforce. What, are you going to disqualify the guy if he throws a closed fist? It's a minor thing. I know it's a minor nitpick, but it just got on my nerves. It's just stupid. Stupid stuff. I'll tell you what else annoyed me in this match. Alex Riley. I don't know if he's legitimately afraid of heights or not, but he, and a lot of wrestlers will do this in a cage match. They'll do this in a ladder match. They'll climb really slow. Maybe the other guy is not coming fast enough or whatever. That sounded dirty. What annoyed me about this in this match is that Riley was at one point trying to climb through the door. And he did this, he was trying to go over the top as well. But he did this when he was trying to go out the door. He was stalling to the point of absurdity. I'm sitting there going, go out of the fucking door. He was just taking forever to do it. I can't get into a cage match like that. When you have two people that, or in this case one person who doesn't know how to be in a cage match, I guess. I mean, maybe this was his first one. Maybe he never was in one before in FCW. I don't know, but anyway, he lost. Alex Riley lost, and as per the stipulation of the match, Alex Riley is now fired from being The Miz's apprentice. Now, from what I understand, Riley may be headed back down to FCW to be repackaged. So, I guess we'll find. Maybe they'll change their mind. I don't know. I guess we're never going to find out why he kept carrying around that briefcase. Apparently, Mike McGilligutty, who got punted by Randy Orton, he too may be going back down to FCW. So that's the story with Alex Riley. But you know, just this, everything about this was an epic fail. The match was a fail. The promo setting it up was a failure. Having a referee in the ring when there's no business for him to be in there in the first place is just stupid. And you know, even the stipulation for if Cena lost, the stipulation was that if Cena lost, okay, this grave stipulation that would just rock the foundation of Monday Night Raw. Was Cena would have to come out on the show next week. This is a main event stipulation, mind you. He'd have to come out on the show next week and admit to the world that The Miz is awesome and the greatest champion of all time. What is this, junior high school? They actually did a similar thing last year with Miz and Bret Hart. So apparently now they're in the business of recycling crappy stipulations as well as all the good stipulations. I didn't like this show. I don't want to talk about this show anymore, so we're going to move on now. Bullet Bob Armstrong going into the Hall of Fame. They didn't announce it on Raw. I guess they didn't have time. They did show, they have a video up for him on WWE.com. Apparently, he's going to be inducted by his sons, Brad Armstrong, who you may remember from WCW, Steve, Scott, who of course is the referee I just mentioned, and Brian Armstrong, who you may know as the Road Dog, who apparently is going to be there as well, and who knows, maybe if the Road Dog has a good showing for himself, maybe they'll give him another shot on TV. So that's the deal with the Hall of Fame. They'll announce a new person, I guess, each week heading into WrestleMania. I mentioned, for those of you who missed it, who the names are, so if you want to know who's going into the Hall of Fame, listen to Sound Off 148. Let's see here. A couple of other notes. John Cena on Twitter finally referred specifically to the UK Sun interview from 2008 that I've been referring to now for weeks. He referred to it by name in a tweet and said that, again, like I said earlier, he would deal a knockout blow to The Rock this Monday. I think, by the way, that this is a great use of Twitter, filling in all the little gaps for the fans. I mean, they really should do this shit on television, but if they're not going to do it on TV, at least, you know, doing it on Twitter. I'm just happy to see that somebody is mentioning this. Because, again, The Rock in his promo on Monday, he kind of, he tried to explain it, but I don't see, I mean, are they not allowed to mention UK Sun? I mean, are they in competition with another publication? What is the big deal? You know, if The Rock would have, it would have made it feel more real when The Rock was talking about Cena years ago trashing him, if they would have put a screenshot on the, on TV of, like, the webpage that had the story. Or played a little bit of an audio clip. I played the audio on this podcast. I like how The Rock was telling people what Cena said, and he said that Cena said, don't, what was the word he used? In any event, he couldn't use the language that Cena used, but at least Cena mentioned it on his Twitter. WrestleMania is it's shaping up pretty well. Trish Stratus apparently is going to be involved, probably in some sort of tag or six-person tag team matchup. There will, in fact, be no Money in the Bank match. They've made the decision. They're keeping the stupid pay-per-view in July. I say stupid because I just think it's stupid to keep it as a concept. I think it's overkill. The Money in the Bank pay-per-view last year was actually a great pay-per-view. But Money in the Bank is not going to mean much if they keep doing this every single year. I think you should have kept Money in the Bank as a WrestleMania match. It means more that way. But apparently they feel otherwise. So I'm not sure if they're going to try to just fit everybody in a pre-show battle royal like they used to do. I guess we'll find out, but that's the deal with WrestleMania. Chris Jericho has officially been announced as part of the cast of season, I believe it's the 12th season of Dancing with the Stars on ABC, so that'll be in direct competition with Tough Enough and Raw, the first hour of Raw on most weeks. He'll be paired off with Cheryl Burke, and there's a couple of other people on the show. I think Hines Ward, I think, is on there. He's a football player. Sugar Ray Leonard, famous boxer, Kirstie Alley, a couple of other people. So I think Jericho's got a real shot. You know, Jericho is a showman. He's a performer. He certainly is not shy of the camera. He's got a fun personality. He's a musician. I mean, he has his own band. He's a singer. I don't know what kind of dancer the guy is. But and if you have enough wrestling fans who call in and vote for him every week, I think Jericho, if he doesn't win, he could certainly go very far. So should be fun to keep track of. There was a story that came out this week from a Brazilian fight magazine called Tatami, or Tatami, whatever it's called, but it was reporting that Strikeforce champion and one of the best MMA female fighters in the world, Cyborg Santos, was negotiating with WWE, said the item in the publication. She has not apparently fought since June of last year. She's been getting very tired of not fighting, and therefore either was given an offer or initiated contact with WWE. It was said that 2 weeks ago, her and her husband, who also was a fighter, attended a WWE event in California, and she was offered a contract. And WWE has since said that there, in fact, was no contract offer made, and apparently she is under contract still to the Strikeforce promotion, which, even if they were going to allow her to do something with WWE, UFC would never allow it. Strikeforce might, but it doesn't matter, because WWE is a lot like UFC. And if they can't have you, they're not going to share you with somebody else. So this just sounds like bullshit to me. I wouldn't put too much stock into it. And so there, that's the story on that. Triple H's movie, The Chaperone, apparently it grossed $14,000. Over its three-day theatrical run. Of course, it'll be on DVD in a week or two. It ran in 10 theaters, so in its defense, it didn't exactly run in too many movie theaters, but let us never, ever confuse Triple H and The Rock. Let's just put it that way. I have not seen The Chaperone. I don't want to say that it sucks, but let's be honest, it probably does. Todd Grisham, a couple of other things here before we get to the mailbag. Todd Grisham on, again, I don't remember if it was the Chris Benoit DVD. It might have been the Benoit DVD, but he did one of these alternate commentary tracks on one of the WWE DVDs. I mentioned this last week, and he pronounced the great, what I was saying as the great Sasuke, or Sasuke, whatever, but he was pronouncing it as the great Sasuke. And a lot of people ripped him a new one for it, and I thought it sounded very awkward. I've never heard another American pronounce it that way, so I just assumed you're doing it wrong. And I was informed by one of our Japanese listeners that, in fact, Grisham was correct. And it is pronounced, at least the proper way in Japan, it is pronounced the great Sasuke. So if that's the case, I'm glad I know now. So hopefully I will not get that wrong in the future. So I just wanted to mention that. I want to give a shout out to... speaking of pronunciation, Riemann Arshad, I hope I pronounced that right, one of our new Sound Off listeners, of which we have had a lot of new listeners come over to the dark side recently, and they really seem to enjoy themselves, and I hope they continue to do so. So I just wanted to give him a shout out. Welcome aboard. Tell your friends and family to listen to the show, because let's be honest, they'd have nothing better to do anyway. So let's, on that note, get into the mailbag. I got a lot of new questions to get to here this week. Actually, you know what? Before I do that, I should talk about TNA just a little bit. They had their big Fayetteville taping. That show aired this week on Spike TV. It aired on Thursday night. That was the show where Sting returned and beat Jeff Hardy to become the TNA World Heavyweight Champion. I did not see it. I only saw part of the show. I saw... what did I see? I don't remember what part of the show I saw, actually. That tells you right there how much of an impression it left on me. Actually, the only thing I really remember from what I watched was I was very impressed with the arena setup. Apparently, they had about 3,500 people legit in that building, which, again, for what the capacity of the building is horrible. But for TNA to bring 3,000 people to a show is actually, it was probably one of, if not their biggest crowd ever. Probably one of their biggest crowds ever. And I was very impressed by the arena setup, not because the setup was anything spectacular, but simply because there's something to be said for getting out of the impact zone. I've said this for the longest time, and I mean, I'm even sick to death of the Raw setup. I mean, they're in a different building every week. They're in a new country sometimes when they tape Raw. But the Raw set has not changed all that much from 1997, when Raw became War for the very first time, and they had the big Titantron and the ramp. So now they don't have a ramp most weeks, so they have a little one. But they still have the same basic setup. They have their HD screen that they invested millions of dollars in. They can put any graphic up there and almost convert what it looks like, which is pretty cool, but it doesn't matter. The arena still looks the same. So in the case of TNA, it's even more apparent, because they're in that fucking impact zone every week, and a lot of the diehards are either not there, or they've paid, you know, there are these women that are always in the front on camera. Apparently they're either, I don't know if they're actresses, but apparently they are paid to be there by TNA. So, I mean, that's just stupid. They got to get out of the impact zone more often, make it more of a special attraction, get on the road. It just makes the show seem important. It makes the show seem fresh. You can put more people in the building. You're not going to get 3,500 people for every impact taping, but you can only fit about 1,000, if that, maybe 1,100. In the impact zone. So you get 2,000 people, 2,500 people, just like you could here in New York at the Hammerstein Ballroom, where they had the one-night stand show, and the old ECW had a couple of pay-per-views. They need to do that more often, and apparently they're not planning to do another impact taping on the road for at least several more months. So, you know, what does it really mean? For 1 week, it was really cool. I didn't really catch much else from the show. Again, I just wasn't around. And I don't have DVR, but if I had DVR, I probably would have been pretty pissed off. And this is just another LOL TNA story. Apparently, again, Dixie Carter went on her Twitter. This is the second time now that she's done this. And she told people, don't miss the end of Impact, because something big is going to happen. And she's right. Something big did happen. But if I'm the president of TNA, again, I don't go on... First of all, I don't go on my Twitter and do that. I would go beyond my Twitter in advertising this show. But regardless, if I went on my Twitter, which, again, is twitter.com/Solomonster, for those of you who don't know, cheap plug, I would go on there and I would say, hey, check out Impact this week. It's a big show. Something big is going to go down. I'm not going to tell you when, but you have to watch to find out. Doesn't that make more sense? But no, this goes on there, and she says, watch the end of Impact. She says, watch the very last part of the show, because something big is going to happen. And apparently, because Impact went overtime, there was an overrun. So, not everybody, but a lot of people who set their DVR for Impact did not take this into account. They did not know, and they missed the end of the show. The only part of the show that the TNA president herself said was going to mean a damn thing, and they missed it because they went overtime. So, I don't know what to say to that. But if I would have DVR'd the show, I probably would have been mighty pissed off. All right, let's get to the mailbag here. Jay Boyer writes in. This is Jay from Florida. Been a faithful follower of the Sound Off since episode 40-something. Just wanted to point out that Sting and the WWE, technically Vince McMahon bought WCW by the time the final Nitro aired on television. Anyone who wrestled that night was working for them. Sting wrestled Ric Flair on that last show, so basically Sting wrestled at least one match with the WWE. It doesn't really matter that much, he says, since he re-signed with TNA, but I just wanted to point out, in case you have not thought of this. It's an interesting thing to point out, but you're still wrong. He did not work for WWE. WWE was running the show that night. Okay, Shane McMahon was there, and I think Bruce Pritchard was there. They were calling the shots. They were putting together the matches. They were running the show, absolutely. And it was a Raw Nitro simulcast, and Vince McMahon was pulling the strings. But Sting's contract was not with Vince McMahon. Sting had either a Turner contract or a WCW contract, but whatever it was, by the letter of the law, according to his contract, he was not working for Vince McMahon. Technically, you can spin it that way, that yeah, he kind of did work for Vince, but not really. He has never been under contract to Vince McMahon or World Wrestling Entertainment. I was not wrong when I said that. You make a very good point, but you're still wrong. Marcel from Chicago wrote this to me last week, and I answered him, but I thought it was worth mentioning here. He wanted to know, if Dixie Carter were to give me 90% control, creative control of TNA. See, I read this to be control. Well, we'll just say 90% control of the company, because that sounds nicer. What are the first 5 things that I would do? And question number 2, we'll just go with question number 1 here. Well, here's what I would do. If Dixie Carter gave me 90% control over TNA, total control, here are the first 5 things I would do. Number 1, I would demand that she surrender the remaining 10% to me. Number 2, once she does that, I would fire her as the president of TNA. Number 3, I would demote Vince Russo to janitor duty. I would not fire him. Not right away. Number 4, I would apologize publicly to all of the TNA fans and sponsors for the last 9 years. And number 5, I would vacate the TNA title and put together a 16-man single elimination tournament for the championship. Because even though Vince McMahon does not like tournaments, if done properly, I do. So those are the first 5 things I would do if I were in charge of TNA. Got a letter here from Mark. He was listening to the Sound Off last week, and he heard in the closing montage at the end of the podcast, I use a clip from my outro. I believe it's Noah Mark who actually made this quote. It says, simply the fastest 60 minutes on the internet. Mark thinks that I should change that because my shows are much longer than 60 minutes. In fact, the last 2 weeks, they've been 2 hours long. That will not be the case this week, by the way. The 2-hour shows are generally the exception and not the rule, but you do make an interesting point. Jesse wrote in, feels really bad for Sheamus, wanted to know if perhaps he's going to be on the future endeavored list. I don't think he will be, but it's interesting you mentioned that. I don't want to really get into it, but after WrestleMania, let's just say that if I were anybody but a main event guy in WWE, I would be very afraid for my job. So that's all I'm going to say about that right now. Got a letter from Scott. Do I find it funny that back in WCW, Eric Bischoff used to spoil the WWF show by posting the results on their live show every Monday night? Yeah, you know, when WWE used to tape Raw, they would have typically one live Raw per month, and then they would tape the next 2 or 3 weeks of TV. And Bischoff would go on Nitro in the first hour, because Nitro would hit the air an hour before Raw did, typically. And Bischoff would be sitting at the announce booth, and he would just read the results. to the other show. And as a WWF fan at the time, when I would check that out, it would piss me off so much. I had such a deep-seated hatred for this man who was sitting here spoiling the show for me. And this, in this case, Scott feels that perhaps it would be only appropriate for WWE to do the same thing to the TNA. He would find it funny if Vince started doing this just to spite Eric for doing this to him. Well, first of all, that's not going to happen. If it was going to happen, it would have already happened sometime in the last year. You know, TNA is not Bischoff's company, so Bischoff, I don't even think, would really give two shits if Vince McMahon went on his show and spoiled it. But TNA is so insignificant to Vince McMahon. I mean, it's insignificant to a point. I mean, again, there's a reason WWE goes out of its way to, you know, put into contracts or make it known that certain people are not to go to TNA. You know, like during their 90-day clause, they can wrestle maybe on the independents, but not in TNA. That has more to do with the fact that TNA just happens to be a national promotion with a TV slot. But it's so insignificant to Vince McMahon. Believe me when I tell you, I'm almost positive of this. And I'm not Vince's personal assistant. I'm not his wife. I'm not his son. But I am sure that Vince McMahon does not spend more than maybe 2 minutes in any given day thinking about TNA, if even that. So it's funny, yeah, but you know what? It's petty. It was shitty when Eric Bischoff did it, because the only people who really suffer are the fans. If you have fans that just don't follow spoilers and they don't want to know what's going to happen, why would you do that to them? It was a dick move when Bischoff did it. It wouldn't be funny if Vince McMahon did it. It would make him no bigger of a man than Eric Bischoff is, and Eric Bischoff isn't much of a man, so I'm thankful that Vince McMahon does not stoop to that level. He doesn't need to. The other part of Scott's question here wants to go back a couple of years to the pre-Kane era of The Undertaker. So, again, we're talking 1996-97. He wants to know what the fuck was up with that teardrop mole-looking thing on Undertaker's face. He does not remember there being a purpose to it being on his face, and it was gone about a year or so later. Was it something to play off the broken orbital bone that he suffered from King Mabel, that was in 95, or just a costume design by the creative team? I do recall Undertaker getting his face burned by a flamethrower, but I doubt that had anything to do with it. I think you might be, I mean, it's possible Undertaker got burned at an angle I don't remember. You might be thinking about Kane. Kane literally got his face on SmackDown burned by X-Pac with some sort of flamethrower. This was back in 2000, so maybe you're confusing the two. But here's the deal with the teardrop mole thing. I was always of the impression that it was some sort of prison tradition, in that if you had murdered somebody, it represented each victim. It was kind of a symbol for each victim that you murdered. And apparently a teardrop tattoo, at least in the American prison system, means that you have, in fact, murdered someone. Now, apparently, it was adopted, from what I'm reading here, from an old Russian custom of Russian prisoners getting them for a litany of different reasons. And when I read this, I certainly hope this does not apply to The Undertaker. I mean, I hope it doesn't apply to The Undertaker anyway. And it doesn't, because I'm almost positive The Undertaker... well, you know what? That's not true. Undertaker murdered his parents, according to Paul Bearer. So, I guess he is a murderer. Then he should have two teardrops on his face. But anyway, in the Russian prison system, apparently it can mean anything from murder of a loved one. So, if you have lost somebody who's been killed, you kind of wear a teardrop in recognition of that person. Or it can mean sexual domination of another prisoner. You know what? I don't even... That's a visual I just don't need. I don't need the visual of Undertaker humbling somebody in a prison cell. I don't need that. So, there you go. That typically is what it's known for. So my guess is Undertaker thought that it would be a cool thing for him. It would make him seem more badass somehow. I just thought it made him look stupid. I thought he just had a mole on his face, and all I could keep thinking was, boy, he should have that thing surgically removed. And apparently he did, because it stopped showing up on his face after about a year or so. So that's the explanation behind it. Sorry for the visual, by the way. Craig from Idaho writes in here. He also thought that Triple H, he was behaving as though he had just woken up from a coma during his promo on Monday night. His question is regarding Santino. Do I ever see Santino being taken out of his current comedic role to be turned into an actual wrestler, or is this his legacy? Well, this is his legacy, because if WWE was going to turn him into a serious wrestler, they would have done so already. They've allowed him to incorporate some more actual wrestling moves into his repertoire recently, but this is his role on the show, and it's not going to change. And the thing is, he's been a comedic figure on TV now for so long, it would be very difficult for him to be anything but that. If one week he suddenly just beat the hell out of Santino, or rather Vladimir Kozlov, and just was becoming a badass, people wouldn't take him seriously. It wouldn't work. So this is what he is, and you know what? It's not a bad gig to have, making people laugh. Santino usually is one of the only few legitimately laugh-out-loud things on Raw. Not all the time, but sometimes. He probably gets paid pretty well, and I know he's pretty good friends with Randy Orton, hangs out with him a lot. He's been with the company now for several years. It's not a bad gig. A lot of people who are aspiring wrestlers, people listening to this podcast, I'm willing to bet, would love to switch places with Santino right now. Plus, you get to make out with Tamina. Yeah. Some people like that. Civ Vicious writes in. First and foremost, love the show. Follow you on Twitter and Facebook. I'm a loyal Sound Off junkie. For my question here, are you familiar with any of the Botchamania, Steinermania, Thundermania, or Vadermania videos on YouTube? You can easily find them. They are hilarious, especially after some Steve Weisers. Thanks for reading and keep up the great work. Great. Now I feel like a drug dealer for enabling your addiction. But thank you. I am definitely familiar with Botchamania, and I'm also very familiar with Steinermania. And in fact, one of my favorite Scott Steiner quotes and clips of all time that you can easily find on YouTube, and there's tons of YouTube videos that are 2 seconds or 3 seconds long with this one quote. It was lifted from what I believe was a sit-down interview that Steiner was doing when he was part of the Main Event Mafia, and it was the Main Event Mafia in the ring. I think Kevin Nash was standing in the background, and Mike Tenay was conducting the interview. And they were all sitting in a circle. And in response to a question about Samoa Joe, who Steiner was feuding with at the time, he loudly proclaimed, quite simply, "He's fat." Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. I don't even do it justice. In fact, let's just play the clip right now.
He's fat!
See? It's short and to the point, but it's absolutely fantastic. That's my favorite Scott Steiner quote from, I think, any of those Steiner Mania videos. But anybody else that hasn't seen Botchamania or the like, from Matthew, I think he's the genius behind those videos, check them out on YouTube. They have, God, how many volumes do they have? They must be up to like 100 and something at this point. So I've seen most of them, and you should too.
He's fat!
George writes into the Sound Off. First time writing in, longtime listener from about the mid-40s. I assume he means episode 40, not the 1940s. Just wondering, in your opinion, what are the best WWE or WWF pay-per-views in the last 10 to 15 years? I feel like, excuse me, I feel like watching some old-school stuff, but only the good ones. Love the show. George from Australia. Here are a few great options I emailed to George, but I figure I'll mention it here in case there's anybody else listening who is in the mood to check out some good classic WWE action. Canadian Stampede, July 1997, one of the company's best pay-per-views of all time. It was also probably one of their shortest, which kind of helps when you don't have too many matches on the card. They only had about 4 or 5 matches, but great show. King of the Ring, 1998, well-known for Mick Foley and The Undertaker and the Hell in a Cell, but Kane also won his very first WWE Championship in a pretty good first blood match with Steve Austin. I remember The Rock having a pretty damn good King of the Ring final that he lost to Ken Shamrock. There was some good stuff on that show. The 2000 Royal Rumble at Madison Square Garden, I was not there. I wish I was. That was the night that Taz made his great debut, one of the all-time great debuts in WWE history. Beat Kurt Angle in the opening match. It was the very first table match with the Hardy Boys and the Dudley Boys. A classic street fight between Triple H and Cactus Jack for the WWE Championship that really put Triple H over and made him feel and seem like a legitimate champion. And that was also the night that Mick Foley took that pretty dumb face-first bump down onto the thumbtacks. And then The Rock won the Royal Rumble. Some people say Big Show won. Big Show did actually win since Rock's feet touched the floor, but we'll just forget that ever happened. And anybody who does check out the 2000 Royal Rumble, especially if it's an original copy that is not edited for content, do yourself a favor, skip over the bikini contest. Just take my word for it. April 2000, the WWF Backlash pay-per-view, another great event. I'm pretty sure it was on that show that Dean Malenko had his great light heavyweight title match with Scotty Too Hotty. Chris Benoit and Chris Jericho had a great match, but The Rock Triple H main event for the WWF Championship, that was when Rock won the title. Rock did not win the title at WrestleMania. It was very disappointing. He did win the title finally the next month. Stone Cold, who had neck surgery only a couple of months earlier and still would not be cleared to return to action for many more months, was on the show. And it's still one of the all-time great moments in WWF history. When Austin's music hit, he came out, beat the hell out of six people with a steel chair. The crowd is going absolutely apeshit. They never once stopped cheering. It was like a long, sustained five or six-minute pop as The Rock delivered the people's elbow to Triple H, pinned him, won the championship. But I just remember when Austin first came out, he was, you know, wearing a T-shirt with a steel chair in tow, but he looked fat. And I'm sure he was a little pudgy because he just had neck surgery. He was wearing a halo around his neck for 3 months before he had it taken off. Probably wasn't working out, and a lot of people on the internet, as soon as the show was over, were online saying, oh my god, Austin's fat. So it was still a great moment. Backlash was a great show. WrestleMania 17 from 2001, probably the best WrestleMania from top to bottom of all time. Survivor Series 2002, MSG, one of the better Survivor Series shows. Anybody that read my Survivor Series editorial on SE Scoops a couple of months ago or knows me knows that Survivor Series, really after 2002, I don't think there's been a single good Survivor Series show. There's probably been some good ones, but I am not a fan of any Survivor Series show after 2002. You know, there was a great Survivor Series match from 2003 that involved Shawn Michaels, but one match does not make a great show. 2002, in my opinion, was the last really good Survivor Series from top to bottom. Brock Lesnar and the Big Show, even though I disagree with putting the belt on Big Show. The very first Elimination Chamber where Shawn Michaels won the World Heavyweight title. Scott Steiner, ironically, made his debut in the WWF that night. Great show. And the very first ECW One Night Stand pay-per-view from June of 2005. This was under the auspices of WWE, so it was technically a WWE show. And if you're not a fan of the old ECW, maybe you won't like the show. But I, as a casual fan up to that point of the original ECW and a diehard WWE guy, love this show to the point that it's one of my all-time favorite WWE pay-per-views. It's probably top three. I had a lot of fun watching the show that night, and if you can get your hands on an original copy so that the Sandman's entrance is not edited and he has his actual Metallica music, Enter Sandman, watch that, because that's not the only good thing on the show, but it's just a lot of fun. And yeah, that would be my list if you want a good selection of great shows that I think will not disappoint. Those are the events that I would hit up first.
He's fat!
Aaron writes in to the Sound Off. Been listening for over a year now. It's the best thing on the internet. I was wondering, why did the NWO fail in WWE in 2002? Was it because Hulk Hogan went so over at WrestleMania 18 with the fans that the NWO was just old and stale, and they decided to, again, which is what they did, they made Hogan a babyface, but was it because the WWE writers couldn't figure out what to do with them? Just wondering what your opinion was on this. Keep up the great work. You make my ride to work enjoyable. Well, thank you, Aaron. It was basically because Hogan was over so much that they saw stars in their eyes, and they didn't waste any time. I mean, Hogan went full babyface the next night, broke up with the NWO. I was still thinking that maybe it was just a ruse and that Hogan would ultimately turn on The Rock and be the ultimate heel, but it never happened. You know, they basically saw the reaction that Hogan got in Canada, and they just decided to go in a different direction. I'm not sure. To this day, I'm actually not sure exactly how this whole thing worked, because if you remember, at WrestleMania, they sent Hall and Nash out there after the match to beat up on Hogan. So I'm of the impression that they basically called an audible, which means during the show, they saw the reaction. They had to have known that weekend, just based on the reaction Hogan was already getting from people, that he was going to be massively over in that building, in the Sky Dome. And So I don't know if this was something they came up with that weekend, if they came up with the idea during the match and they said, you know what, we're going to call an audible here, we're going to send Hall and Nash out there. I still don't know the answer to that, but it was the Hogan face turn that basically doomed the NWO. The NWO didn't officially die off completely until July. I mean, they had Shawn Michaels join the NWO, I believe, in June. And then Booker T joined the NWO. The Big Show joined. They had X-Pac join. So, you know, they were doing things with it. But then Nash tore his quad. Hall was already gone by that point. We knew he wasn't going to last very long. They kicked Booker T out of the group. Shawn Michaels super kicked him in the face. The NWO became a sad skeleton of its former self. And that was when they decided, you know what, it's not worth it to keep it around. It's not worth it to bastardize it anymore, which I agree with. I mean, I fully agreed with their decision, still do. At that point, you just kill it off because you're not going to do the group any favors. So it was a combination of all those things that really doomed it. But I think when Hogan went face and people realized that he wasn't going back to the NWO, he was back to the red and yellow. Not that you needed Hogan to make the NWO a success, but the whole premise was the original three were coming in to, quote, invade. And within a month, Hogan, who was the big star of the group, was already out of the group. Hall was fired shortly thereafter, so then you're left with Kevin Nash. It just wasn't going to work.
He's fat!
All right, we got a question here from Mr. Ramen, who I mentioned earlier, one of the new listeners of the Sound Off. One of his questions here, I was watching The Rock's promo from Raw Monday night and was wondering the belts, don't call them belts, the titles that he had in his trophy case in his house, were those real belts, the real belts that he held, or replicas presented to him when he won them? I'm almost positive they're not the actual belt, but they're not replicas the way that you would go on a website or go to a live event and buy one. I'm of the impression that it's a replica of the real thing, meaning that it's basically a facsimile of the real belts that they carry around, the same plates, real leather strap. I think the replicas they sell, I think the plates are like 2 millimeters and the real ones are like 4, something like that. So I think it's a, quote, real replica, if that makes any sense, that he has in his trophy case there. And it's a very impressive display, I must admit. If I had won 2 or 3 different world championships, I'd probably put them in a glass case on display too. But, you know, there's been wrestlers that have requested that in the past. Bret Hart, for example, has replica belts that he has a replica of the tag team title, the Intercontinental title, the WWF title in his home, or at least he did once upon a time. And again, I don't believe it's a situation where he won the belt and they let him keep it for himself and just made a new belt to use on TV. I think he probably went to them at some point and said, listen, I'd like to have a replica of this. Can you go to the belt maker, go to one of your backups, which I'm sure they have at least one backup at all times, and maybe they gave it to him and that's what he has on display.
He's fat!
Jack writes in to the podcast, I remember that WWE Films had an idea for a movie that was going to be about the origins of The Undertaker. It was going to have a Western theme to it. Seeing The Undertaker on SmackDown coming out to the Johnny Cash song and now having the new nickname The Last Outlaw, I feel that this character is the one that we should have seen in that movie. There was something different about The Undertaker on SmackDown. What do you think? Yeah, I would have no problem with that. I mean, I haven't heard much about the movie since then, so I don't know if it's been shelved or not. When I first heard that was, I think it was just an idea. It was maybe a script that they had commissioned, but that was a long time. It was like over a year ago, maybe more. I have not heard a word about it since then, so I don't even know if that's still in the plans or not. But, you know, the Undertaker character seems like it would be one that would be ripe for some sort of sci-fi movie or something. Which would be different than, you know, the same old bullshit we've seen from them. You know, The Chaperone and Legendary, blah, 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 blah. It seems like The Undertaker, if you're going to go in that direction, would make for a far more interesting film. So I would certainly be in favor of it.
He's fat!
And lastly, a letter here that I just want to read. Not so much a question, but it's from a reader, Matt, from South Korea. Dear Solomon, sir, I've used the Sound Off to keep up with wrestling for the last year, somewhere around episode 85-ish or so. I'm in the service, currently stationed in South Korea for the past year. Started watching TNA around 2005, and I loved it. WWE was getting old. Still a TNA mark for now, probably because I haven't been able to watch the show for the last year. I totally agree with you that they need a real change, and since they can't get Heyman and won't fire Bischoff, Hogan, or Russo, I vote that you run TNA. Oh, God, no. Please, no. If you like me or the show, you would not say that. If I had the money, I would give it to you to buy out TNA, but something tells me that you might not want to associate your name with them right now. Well, there you go. Anyways, I enjoy the podcast. Thanks for keeping me up to date on wrestling. Quick note, my first live show was WCW Super Brawl 3 in Asheville, North Carolina. I remember the strap match with Sting and Vader very well. Almost too vivid, since I was 11 at the time. I watched it on YouTube recently, and when the camera panned the crowd, my dad and I were on TV. Thought that was cool. Keep up the good work. So, thank you to Matt for all that you do and for listening to the Sound Off. I very much appreciate it. I have a couple of other letters here. I will try to either respond directly when I get back next week, or we'll get them in the mailbag next weekend, all right? So, keep sending in your questions. TheSolomonster@gmail.com is the email address to do so. Hit me up on Twitter, twitter.com/Solomonster. We're up over 725 followers now, and closing in on 700 Facebook friends as well, facebook.com/TheSolomonster. As I mentioned last week, I'm actually going to be flying out, not tonight, although I haven't even packed yet, so I probably should get to that, but tomorrow, Sunday, I'm flying out to, flying down, I should say, to Florida. I'm going to hit up some Met spring training games and get a tour of the complex and all that stuff, and so I'll try to snap some photos and do some updates on Twitter and Facebook, which is all the more reason for you to sign up there if you haven't already done so while I'm gone. I'm flying back here on Thursday night, so this should have no impact at all, no pun intended, on me doing a podcast as usual next weekend. In fact, maybe I could even do one a little earlier. No guarantees, but so that should not be an issue, but I'm looking forward to getting out of here, and hopefully where I'm going to be, there'll be cable, because I'm looking forward to Raw Monday night. I'm looking forward to seeing Stone Cold and what they do as part of the next chapter of the Jerry Lawler-Michael Cole feud, and John Cena will respond to The Rock. I hope whatever he's got up his sleeve is damn good, because so far The Rock is up on him 2-0. 2-0 in this rivalry so far. I'm like a UFC judge. It's a little controversial, but I think I've got the right idea here. I don't know that Cena has dealt that knockout blow. He claims he's going to do it this Monday night, and hopefully I'll be able to watch it. So we'll see you back here next weekend, the 150th episode of The Sound Off. Can't believe it's been that long. It's just like yesterday that I recorded our 100th episode, and now we're 50 up on that. Before you know it, it's going to be episode 200. So we'll do 150 first. We'll do that next week. And as always, me getting to that point, it's all because of you guys. I wouldn't be at episode 150 if it wasn't for everybody listening. And we've got more and more people listening each and every week. Spread the good word of the Sound Off. And thank you, as always, for listening. I got to pack and get the fuck out of here. So we'll see you next week. Have a good one, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joe from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SCScoops.com.
He's fat!